So the eighth and final limb of the Eightfold Path sequence is called Samadhi. It's often translated as concentration. I don't love the translation. A lot of us don't in the biz, partly because the word concentration in English often comes with an assumption of effort and tension. It seems like I'm going to concentrate, or, I have to concentrate really hard. The adjective hard often goes with concentration. So, but as it turns out, that's hardness and effort don't support samadhi. They're not actually the qualities that give rise to the concentrated mind. The word samadhi itself, samma, means to balance or to assemble or bring together. And the root dhi shows up in a lot of different words that have something to do with the mind. So I like the translation integration of mind, the bringing together of the mind. And this is a little bit of a metaphor, like what is the mind that's being brought together? There's a whole series of beautiful metaphors in the texts for what the activity of the mind generally is and what happens when we bring it together. So I'll tell you what a few of those. There's the sense that when in ongoing life our attention is interacting with the world, what it's doing is, like when we're just doing stuff, having conversations with people, doing activities, or just sitting and not trying to concentrate, especially if we're untrained in concentration or integration. I'll use both words in kind of alternation. That what the mind does is it, attention, let's say the attention aspect of the mind, hooks onto sensations and thoughts and feelings, so stimuli, phenomena, hooks onto them as they show up. And the old metaphor for this in the texts is of a monkey, a restless monkey, swinging from branch to branch, never stopping. It grabs onto this one, it grabs onto that one, it jumps to that one, it grabs this fruit, it jumps onto that branch. It stops to eat the fruit, then it throws it aside and jumps onto another branch. It just keeps going. So you might know this mind, this monkey mind. You might be quite intimate with it. You might enjoy it. There's a certain dynamic kind of vitality to the mind that is active and keeps moving, is nimble. We could shift into, Silicon Valley positive adjectives for the restless mind and call it disruptive and creative, which it is. And it's exhausting to never stop. So the nature of attention is to connect with sensation. And by sensation, I mean the five physical senses plus the subtle senses that we call thought and feeling, essentially. The subtle aspects of mind or experience. So a sensation comes along. The cushion is ever so slightly uncomfortable. The discomfort of the sensation makes it kind of ping up or rise up out of the general field of more or less neutral sensations, and it calls out to attention. And one of the things attention does, and we'll talk about this next month when we do trauma physiology, one of the things attention does is that it's alert to danger. So if I was sitting and I felt a very sharp, painful sensation, my attention would go there as a very natural self-protective maneuver. It might be like, oh, I'm sitting on a tack. Ouch. Right? And it goes, ouch. And attention goes there, and if it's a very strong sensation, attention becomes reflexive action very quickly. If it's a dull sensation, attention tends to just stick there because it's not sure if it's dangerous. Right? I feel a little ache in my knee. It's like, is this an injury? Am I hurting myself? I don't know. I heard that you shouldn't hurt your knees. Maybe I should change posture. Maybe I should get one of those special cushions. My knee really hurts. Maybe I should go to Dr. Ziegler. He's really good with knees. I heard this bad... Mom, my friend had a bad knee. She had to have her tendon replaced. I don't really don't want that. Maybe I shouldn't meditate. Maybe I should do CrossFit instead. Like, the attention. So we can think of this a couple of ways. This is like standard mind wandering. But we could also think of it compassionately as my poor little attention thinks it's under threat. My physiology thinks it's under threat. And what it's doing is it's hooking on to the evidence of that threat and is staying there because it is not sure whether the threat is real. And so then I chew on it and chew on it, and I look around it in lots of ways. One of the necessary conditions for the mind to settle is for it to actually understand, and that means the body, mind, to really understand that it's not under threat. If I don't know that I'm not under threat, I will not be able to concentrate. Because the mind must, as an animal mind, it must be alert to threat. It's very difficult to disconnect those things. It's very difficult to be calm when there's a threat, even if there's not one. Even if the threat happened when you were six. But you sit in a room of people and the mind goes, I don't belong here. These people don't like me. They're all so beautiful, but I'm not. They're all so cool. Maybe they've been meditating a long time. I think this is an advanced group. I think I should go across town to somebody else's group where I'll fit in. Maybe I should just do CrossFit. Oh, wait, all those people, they're really strong. I can't do that. So it doesn't matter in a way to some part of the attention if it logically is safe here and now, if it doesn't feel it. So I think this is part of why the mind runs with anxiety and restless thought. And so then the unbinding of those patterns requires the sensation, the perception, physically, of safety. With that as a foundation, then, the activity of integrating the mind begins with renunciation, a type of renunciation. And the renunciation is that we are willing to not follow those sensations, other sensations and feelings. There's a little ache in the cushion, in the butt on the cushion, and I'm okay with that. I'm like, yep, I'm sitting on a folded yoga blanket. It's not the most comfortable thing in the world. I don't care. Part of samadhi, part of settling, is a very skillful not caring about other things for a little while. I remember something I have to do at work, and the threat alert mind is going to go, oh, I got to do that. I got to plan it. Oh my gosh, what if it doesn't go well? I should really, why did I come to this group tonight? I really have work to do. Maybe I should stay up till midnight. Maybe I should stay up till 2. But then I won't get enough sleep. And then I... Alert to threat, to danger. Part of the practice of learning to settle is to go, worried about work. Fine. Right now I'm just breathing. Work will be there. Doesn't matter if I'm going to stay up, but I'm not going to plan it now. There's nothing to be done about this right now. And again, I have to trust that. I can't be like, you know, like if I assign my students papers to be due at midnight on the day that they're due, partly because I want them to get sleep, but still feel like they have all day and late into the night to just push up till 11:59. So if you had a paper due in my class at 11:59 and you were here and you hadn't written it at all, then you haven't set up the conditions for the mind to perceive safety. Right? It's going to be very hard to let that go and sit. And I wouldn't advise you to. I would be like, oh, you have too much to do right now. Go do the paper. Or decide you're not going to turn it in tonight and sit, right? But make the decision so you don't have to worry about it. Some huge part of this practice is figuring out how to not worry about things, how to structure your life, how to not worry about things. This was a huge piece of the early monastic practice, right? It wasn't just be celibate, live in the forest. It was simplify your life so radically that you have very little to think about. You go begging for your one meal, you come back, you're with your friends, there's nothing to do. You have two outfits of clothing, right? You wash the one, you wear the other. That's it. If you own nothing, you have very little to protect and take care of. This quality would really be amplified in the Tao and Zen traditions, where Zen Master Rinzai, the sort of patron saint of my first training lineage, Rinzai Zen, said, you know, the true man of the way has nothing to do all day long. And these kind of invocations to having nothing to do fill the Chinese and Japanese kind of Zen and Chan and Taoist canons. They really went far with that particular instruction. So we cultivate a renunciation of following every impulse. And again, safety as a foundation for that. I think there's a second foundation as well, and again, I'll talk about this in the trauma work next month, which is that even if we have cultivated some sense of safety, but there's been so much suffering or stress or pain in our life that even though I know I'm safe, I'm still kind of hurting, either in my heart, I'm heartbroken, or my body's just injured. There's some way that if there's too much pain, it's also difficult to concentrate. And this has a big footnote to it, which is that some Buddhist lineages really love physical pain as a support for concentration. It's true that if you sit for 3 hours and your hip is burning in like morphing lava flows of fierce pain, it's pretty hard to concentrate, think about anything else. So you concentrate on that, and look, you're concentrated. And of course, in lots of disciplines, folks use intense sensation as a way to concentrate. So it works. But it works in a particular way, and it's different than the type of ease-based, pleasure-based concentration that's actually in the early texts. There's very little in the Theravada texts of the Pali Canon that recommend, you know, sitting through intense pain as a way to get concentrated. Turns out that one of the most supportive conditions for sustained concentration over a long period of time, and that means like, you know, really getting good at dropping into these states, is not just the perception of safety, but pleasure. Particularly a non-sensual pleasure. And that's important. If there's a pleasure that's coming through a certain sense perception being triggered, like the pleasure of a certain physical contact, let's say I really like getting a massage, which I do, that's very pleasurable. And I get a little concentrated when I'm getting a massage because the pleasure is so nice and I feel safe and I get to drop in. But I've never been able to tell my massage person to just keep going for 7 hours without stopping. Like, eventually they're always like, okay. And I'm like, no! Don't stop! And I'm always like, someday I'm going to be rich, and I'm going to get them to like just tag team and just like flow in and out. And I'm just going to lie here until I'm done. Darn it. The trouble with pleasures that are attained through particular sensations, which includes thoughts and feelings, is that they're unreliable. You can't actually sustain them. They end relatively soon. It's pretty hard to sustain a sensual pleasure for more than a handful of minutes. So the pleasure that the texts speak about actually is called, the literal translation is the bliss or pleasure of seclusion. And it's a little bit, it's a very interesting pleasure. The pleasure of less happening. The pleasure that's not based in a sense contact of any kind. When I was a child, sitting at the dinner table, refusing to eat, yada yada yada, my parents would be like, go to your room. So I would get up, and I would go to my room, and I would shut the door, and instantly, this feeling of ease. Ah. I'm free from the need to interact. I was that kid. After a little while, they figured out, they were like, oh, Sean prefers going to his room than sitting at the table. And then it was like, you stay where you are. And I'm like, make me go to my room. And they're like, no, you stay here. So it only worked a handful of times. They caught on to me. But the concentration born of seclusion, the bliss of seclusion. And what this is really, and you can taste it in your meditations. You already have tasted it. It's why you keep coming back to meditation, ultimately, I think, is that when the attention is resting on a relatively neutral or neutral to pleasant focus, and it's not being pulled by other focuses, foci, whether pleasant or unpleasant, that's not only stabilizing, but it actually feels good. It feels good in a kind of subtle but delicious way. And part of increasing your samadhi or increasing meditative stability is learning to enjoy that subtle pleasure more and more. Tuning into it. That thing that you can sense where like the mind's been doing all its thing, you focus on something for me it takes about 3 breaths for it to kick in. The first few breaths, the mind still could be just like the monkey gripping onto a branch and just slightly slowing down in its swing, but there's still momentum to grabbing the other one. The thought is coming, the next feeling is coming. But if I can resist that, and it takes, a teeny little hump of effort to resist going on to the next thought, something happens, the system kind of downshifts. And that downshifting, and it kind of broadens, and it becomes easier to stay with the breath. The pleasure is not sharp. It's not the sharp pleasure of like, I had a bite of a brownie today, and it was like, or like I talked to someone I really love, and I you know, saw a friend at the market and leaned in for a little kiss and saw my people that I like, and my whole system was like, yeah, well, I love it, I love it. Bursts of sensation and emotion. It's not that kind of pleasure. It's more like, ah. And like, it's almost like the shoulders drop for me, and it's just like, less is happening. And so we can learn to appreciate that dropping. Not as a like, oh, the fun is gone. But actually like, ah, enough fun for now. And learning to appreciate that is the doorway to it deepening substantially. The Buddha was visited by the minister of a king at one point. And the minister is skeptical about this renunciation thing. Because the Buddha, and he says, you know, a blessed one, you live out here in the woods, you live on one meal a day, you live in this tiny hut, you have one article of clothing, it's kind of hot or cold or buggy or rough out here. Why do you do it? And the king says, tell me, minister, or the Buddha, sorry, says, "Tell me, minister, the king for whom you work, does he experience pleasure?" And the minister says, "Oh, yes, he experiences great pleasures." And the Buddha says, "What are his pleasures like?" And the minister says, "Oh, well, he has the best food, you know, and every day new, different foods come, and he has 100 wives and all these children and horses and elephants, and he has palaces for every season and pleasure gardens, and whenever he wants, he can go to a new, exciting place and a show and all of these things. It's so pleasurable." And the Buddha says, "Yes, but the king does not enjoy those pleasures because his mind is always a little worried about his realm being invaded and his money being lost and his sons quarreling or dividing up the realm, or him being assassinated, or his wives turning against him." He gave a whole list of you know, reasons why people in power worry. You know, none of those pleasures are actually reliable, it turns out, from the Buddha's fairly vast view. And the Buddha says, "But minister, living here in the forest, the way that I live, having cultivated the mind, I can enter a state of profound contentment, blissful, rapturous happiness for 1 hour, 3 hours, a day, 3 days, 7 days without a break, without a pause, in profound, rapturous happiness. And I can do this anytime I choose. Who do you think has the greatest pleasure?" And the pleasure that the Buddha was speaking to in entering those states is the pleasure of meditative stability. This is samadhi, the integration of the mind. The pathway goes something like this. You begin to unlearn the vigilance of constant threat, and you begin to learn the pleasure of stability and letting go. Tuning into that pleasure and stability, you begin to drop away from all the things that pull the mind away. And that dropping goes quite far. The stages of that dropping in a formal sense, are a sequence of states. And they're described with these beautiful metaphors and descriptions, very precise descriptions of the states. Entering these states is absolutely the heart of the meditation practice the Buddha was teaching. In a certain way, they are more important than mindfulness. Or they're mentioned many, many more times in the texts than mindfulness. Mindfulness is a tool that helps you attain these states a bit more than the other way around. In later traditions, the importance was shifted, and mindfulness took on a much greater importance, and samadhi was somewhat de-emphasized. And there are entire lineages that believe that deep samadhi is no longer possible or not even necessary. And I disagree with both assertions. The sequence goes something like this, and I'll talk about it a little more next week. But I want to speak to it particularly in relation to a sequence of really two things. One is a sequence of progressively deeper letting go, or renunciation, and then a sequence of progressively more awesome pleasures. And they're connected, of course. So the formula is basically this: the more you let go, the better it feels. The doorway to these profound states, which are called jhana, or dhyana, it means absorption, being fully absorbed. The doorway to these is called access or neighborhood samadhi. For the Pali Canon technical people here in the room or out in Radio Land, I'm going to speak not completely precisely weaving between the Sutta Jhana and Vasuddhimagga Jhana systems. So just so you know, that's what I'm doing. Next week, maybe I'll speak a little more about those two systems. Access or neighborhood concentration is a state mentioned, emphasized in the commentaries primarily, as the practitioners begin to really work out the fine details of entering these states. And we practiced two of the most important aspects of generating access concentration. Access means you're not fully absorbed yet, but you're assembling the conditions for that. And there's two skills at the heart of that that begin it, that we did in our instructions today. And these are the skills of connecting and sustaining attention. So the monkey swinging from branch to branch, the contact with the branch is connection. Connection happens all the time. The mind connects with things over and over very quickly. And so the thing that inclines us, shifts us towards samadhi, is sustaining. So you choose a focus, like the breath or the nose tip, and then sustaining is the thing that, for me, that takes a teensy bit of effort. Right? And you can do it with a lot of effort, but if that's going to get tiring quickly. You have to do it with a minimal effort, because you have to do it for a long time for it to work. Meaning it takes a few minutes of really not getting distracted in order for momentum to gather. Doesn't take years and years, it takes a few minutes. And then the tone in the mind shifts. Connect with something and sustain the attention there. Nose tip is a good object for concentration because it's a small focused place. So I connect with the in-breath. And I sustain the attention through the in-breath. And then I don't lose it as it turns around. The attention shifts a teeny bit when the sensation shifts to the out-breath. And rather than getting distracted by something else, I reconnect and re-sustain. Connecting and sustaining. The Pali words for this are vitaka and vichara. And there's lots of translations of them. I like connect and sustain. One of the teachers of my teachers uses the translation contacting and rubbing. Like, contact the object and then kind of get into it, massage it, dig into it with your attention. It's a little more active, which is nice. So connect and sustain. When those two factors really begin to mature, everything else that happens, happens on its own. This is an autonomic system. And so the next primary thing that assembles is a quality called piti that's often translated as rapture. And so this is like you're not even into absorption yet, and the pathway is connect with something and stay there until it gets good. And rapture is pleasurable, mostly. Sometimes it's a little jangly, but it's a physiological response to concentration. The body gets kind of bright or fuzzy or tingly or energetic, wavy. The commentaries describe several types of rapture. They say there's momentary rapture, there's showering rapture, there's lightning-like rapture, there's rapture that's pervasive, there's rapture that's like an eruption and a flowing over. This is the spot in the canon that starts to sound orgasmic. It's this exact spot, rapture based in concentration. And again, the difference from sensation-based orgasm is that it's sustainable for a very, very long period of time. And again, when you get good at it, we're talking hours, days. So the pathway goes like this. You establish connection. You sustain that connection. And what happens as you sustain is the longer you sustain contact with something that's non-sensuous, meaning other sensations or thoughts or feelings, the impulse to be pulled away starts to wane. As the impulse to be pulled away starts to wane, the settling of that impulse seems to kind of flower through the body as relaxation and ease. It's a little bit like, you can think of it muscularly, almost like if my arm is always ready to kind of reach out for something, there's going to be a tension that just builds in the musculature. And so the restraining of that impulse initially takes a little doing. You have to try to not do it. But after a little while, it's like, oh, that's nice. And maybe you are contacting the impulse to move and allowing it to kind of settle. And again, this has its parallel in the trauma work. One of the most substantial types of trauma symptom is the physiological or the muscular readiness for fight and flight. Right? The legs are ready to run, the arms are ready to fight back. Again, for concentration or stability of mind, just like we need to restrain the part of the mind that pings off to sensations, we also need to momentarily settle those muscular impulses. And so this is a stillness practice. And very few traditions enter these kinds of states in movement. This is also the place where, if your primary practice is yoga asana, especially movement flow, this is the place where you stop and you sit or you lie down. You can cultivate concentration, connecting and sustaining, and a lot of rapture in movement. But for it to sustain into these profoundly deep states, and for it to unhook from the physical pleasure of moving, we need stillness. And again, that's the important part of this pleasure, is that it's not sense-oriented. Right? If we're getting pleasure through maintaining a vinyasa flow, that's a beautiful, it's a wholesome pleasure. I love it. But again, it's not sustainable. You can only flow for so long. And so then the natural arc of a practice is to arc back into stillness. And then the attention shifts from a sense-oriented pleasure to a release-oriented pleasure, a letting-go-oriented pleasure. As we let go and the state drops, the first levels are active, and then activity falls away. And I'll just tell you the first two right now. And we'll go more into jhana in the map a little bit next week, and more details on how to cultivate the basic conditions for it. The first state called jhana is a state where these two activities of aiming and sustaining, connecting and sustaining, or vitaka and vichara, are prominent. And it's a state that is very concentrated and very pleasurable, but there's a little bit of doing in it. You're still working it. And the metaphor given is of a bath maker, a bathman, or a bathman's apprentice. And what the bath person does is takes soap powder, bath powder, and adds just enough water to make it into a ball. I don't know how many of us make a ball of bath powder when we take a bath. But you can think of, if you've ever made bread or a pastry, how you take dry flour and you knead moisture into it just enough to make a dough, but not too much that it seeps water out and not too little that it doesn't hold together. And so the metaphor is, the passage goes, just as a skilled bathman or a bathman's apprentice takes bath powder and kneads water into it until the ball of bath powder is fully soaked and saturated with the water, but does not drip. So too does a meditator knead and press and saturate the body with pleasure so that it is fully saturated, but does not drip or bleed off. We take the pleasure of stability and knead it into the whole body. So the process of doing that seems to be a little bit like, it's a little energetic, it's a little concentration, like where you put your attention-y. It's a little bit like, oh, I feel a little bit of this pleasure, but I'm still kind of tense. Can I let this pleasure kind of wash into the tension? Can I relax the tension, stay focused, let the pleasure broaden? Oh, it tensed up. Soften. Reconnect, resustain, don't try so hard. I'll Can it wash more open into me this way? Can I wash the pleasure of letting go down into the arms? And it's a little active, and you need that pleasure out into the body. So for some folks, very technical. For some folks, very intuitive. Just like, just let it pervade. From there, the steps continue with less and less effort and an arc of pleasure where the pleasure also gets subtler. Rapture turns into simple happiness. Happiness in the flavor of contentment. And then happiness turns into pure equanimity. And equanimity turns into open space, etc. The last thing I'll say about it for tonight is that part of what these instructions point to is that the whole path of liberation in the early system begins and ends with renunciation. It's really a letting go path. It really says, what are we getting hooked on in our belief systems, in our actions, and then what happens when we let them go? What happens when we let them go really deeply? And it turns out that letting go a little bit of like an emotional pattern that's troubling you leaves ease and happiness in the realm of that pattern. Letting go more deeply into deep patterns of who we think we are and how we relate to people softens or brings ease to those patterns. And then at the level of samadhi practice, which again is a fairly mature practice, you've done a lot of other work before this practice really takes off. The letting go is on the subtle level of micro-impulse in thought and feeling and action, and just letting the micro-impulses float off the body like something that's no longer needed. And the ease that comes there is the ease of a person who is now really substantially free already, quite not bound to things. And that unbinding, which is the quality of nirvana or nibbana, just continues. It gets subtler and subtler. More and more layers of ourself that get bound or hooked let go. Not through force, but just through, oh, could I relax that? And it relaxes, and a subtler joy appears in its place. Thanks for listening. Pleasure. Just responses, thoughts, and feelings. Anything about your practice? Here. Yeah, there we are. Please.
I really appreciate so many things about you. But especially, it feels, I want to speak only kind words. There's a contrast in my experience of Western Buddhism, where it feels like a lot of times mindfulness is sort of airlifted out of the whole path and solely emphasized. And as I've, in my practice, really decided to deepen and devote myself to the path, seeing all of these other aspects that I felt were sort of missing from my contact with the Dhamma and my seeking of it. And I really appreciate what feels to me like a risk that you take to speak to the whole path, the whole piece, especially about renunciation, which feels very unpopular in the West and also particularly in America. So that's the first part of what I want to say. And the second is that in my own practice, and just in being a human, the more I let go, the more joy and happiness there really is of my stuff, of my agendas, of my thought patterns. It's really true.
I'm so glad to hear that it's true.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And the subtlety of, when I first began practicing, of like a vigilant mind, which is that piece that you're speaking about with the trauma of like mindfulness, but of like noticing everything, but not from a relaxed place.
Yeah.
More from a place of like, I need to know where the door is in the room and
totally.
The, like every sound and it was like at first I was like, I'm really mindful, but it was like with this shoulders like up here and this like really tense. And so the ability to have that mindfulness be full, but not the edgy fear in it, is also been really releasing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So thank you.
Absolutely.
So much.
You're
and
so
thank
welcome.
Thank you all for receiving my work.
I'm glad to have you back. Mm-hmm. That kind of vigilant mindfulness is mindfulness. And we have to do it until we don't. Right, because it's there for a purpose, right? So, so much compassion for the minds that do that, and for, I don't want to say all, because I've met a few extraordinarily untraumatized people in my life, but most of the people I know during phases of our life do that, right? There's that, and so figuring out how to create the conditions for that to let go. Very good. So I'm happy to hear it. Yeah, Natai.
Thank you, Sean.
You're welcome.
I feel like I am such a beginner in all of those things. And when you're talking about how to focus your attention, how to try to focus on it, tip of your nose, or redirect your mind, or let go, I'm getting lost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not that I'm not following directions, but I can't quite put it together. So, I'm just curious about your experience. When you started practicing many years ago, did it come to you someday, like, a more intuitive level, where you kind of knew what you're doing, and it was not that technical? Because to me, it's like, okay, what am I letting go? Like, it's like, it's just like, sometimes those words don't really mean things to me, and while you talk, you lose, like, I'm getting lost on multiple occasions, because I'm following you, and then I'm not following you, and then I'm trying to remember what you said a few minutes ago, and you're already in a new place, doing CrossFit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Don't go and do CrossFit. I mean, unless you want, but it's true. And this particular topic tonight is speaking about mindfulness specifically in relation to samadhi or concentration. It is among the more technical aspects of the kind of instruction that I give, and it's not fully a beginner's instruction, so it's appropriate to be lost. You asked how I found my way into it myself, and I'll honestly say that I heard essentially these instructions, I'm sure, hundreds of times before I felt like I could orient myself in my own sitting. For the first several years of my practice, I had no idea how to focus my mind. All I did was I sat there in pain thinking about houses. That's what I did, right? And eventually someone was like, no, when your mind wanders, come back to the breath. And I was like, oh, right, you've been saying that. Okay. And then for the next 10 years, I tried doggedly to do that and felt like I mostly failed. Like, I just can't do it. My mind is a mess. I'm falling asleep. I'm thinking about things. I'm trying to stay with my breath, but I'm thinking about Harry Potter. Why? I was a monk in Burma. I did the whole thing. I'm sitting there in my little red robe under my mosquito net in Burma. I'm doing something that almost no American Buddhists ever do. And I woke up from a distraction, and I was like, wow, I just talked myself through the entire 7th book of Harry Potter, naming all the horcruxes. Why did I have to do that? Like, I can't do this. Like, I can't focus on the breath. Apparently, I could focus on Harry Potter. Right? So it's hard. And the thing you're speaking to, and in a way the thing that Ariel is speaking to, and the thing that I'm speaking to now in not being able to focus, all of those kinds of things, whether it's vigilance or kinds of confusion or just pure, like, where did the monkey even go kind of restlessness, all of these I consider aspects of trauma. Something, and where trauma speaks spoken very broadly, most of our jobs are kind of traumatic right now. Most of our families are just stressful. And so, like, I just couldn't settle. And I heard the instructions on settling over and over, and I couldn't settle. So, patience, for sure. But more than patience, the thing that I really want to emphasize is that this practice builds on foundations. And the foundation, in a certain way, is being at ease in ourself. And that takes a lot of things, you know. It's probably more important for a beginning meditator to have good friends than it is for them to have, you know, a brilliant teacher or a perfect sitting space or hips that don't hurt. So I hear you, and that it's challenging, and I'm glad to just keep seeing you here and have you as part of the community. And you're doing great, and everybody's doing great, and it's a wounded, it's a hospital, one of my teachers says, you know. And it's like, you know, if you're not sick, you don't need to be in the hospital, right? If you're liberated, you don't need to come to satsang. So everyone who comes here is working on it.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, please, go.
You were saying that you kind of got into those conditions of samadhi, right? Where it lasted for several days. So eventually it did happen. And when it happened, like, did you, like, walk yourself through that? Or you just found yourself there without kind of realizing you're going there?
Two things. First of all, I can't stay in samadhi for several days. And actually, I don't have very good samadhi at all. I can get into very, very light, gentle kinds of concentration. But I've studied it very deeply, and I just wrote my dissertation on it. So I've talked with people that can do this very, 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 very profoundly. And one of the things that I know from that study is that, like a lot of other things that are talents, like music, which I also spent a lot of time working at and I was talented at, but not as talented as some folks, is it just comes easier to some people. Some folks very naturally can enter deep concentrated states. Some folks can't. Many of us never will enter these kind of classical states of, like, profound bliss for many hours. It's okay. Because even the most beginning steps of just learning to focus and stabilize a little bit are profoundly helpful. Even being a beginner at samadhi is profoundly helpful. And the mindfulness instructions that are everywhere now are essentially, in many cases, beginning samadhi instructions. Right? They're just like, learn to settle into the body a little bit. And that's really useful. So the first part is, I'm not particularly good at it. The second part of your question is, did it happen suddenly or gradually? And I'll say that for myself and almost everyone I know, 99.999% of meditators, it happens gradually. I've been working at this for years and years and years. Same instructions, connect, sustain, nose tip. I've probably been working on those instructions for 15 years. Don't lose hope. You're young. There's time. But it takes time to cultivate, especially in a cuckoo society. Maybe if I'd stayed a monk, I would be further along. Maybe not. It's hard to say. It is true that for the 0.001% of people that are good at this, it doesn't take that long. Right? I interviewed for my dissertation folks who said, yeah, I was on my first retreat. I'd never done anything like this before. My girlfriend told me to come. I was like, whatever. I was totally skeptical. But then I heard this instruction and I sat down. And then my mind just opened into like vast space and hours went by. And I was like, dude, that's awesome. And then I came out and I went to the teacher and I said, this just happened. And the teacher went, really? And then the teacher convinced me to move into the monastery, and then I didn't leave for 5 years, and here I am. And I'm like, right, some people, they can do that. But, you know, not me. So, you're welcome. Thanks for asking. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you talk a little bit more about safety, specifically?
Yeah.
You know, as a requirement, I think we're all under some amount of existential threat.
Absolutely.
Personal.
Absolutely.
Existential angst.
Absolutely.
And it seems like a real undermining of that tenet.
It is real. All right, so safety, a little bit on safety. The most important thing, my sense of the most important thing for safety in relation to these kinds of states, meditative states, healing also, is that we need to differentiate between absolute safety or kind of three kinds of safety. Basic physical safety or sort of psycho-emotional safety. Like, am I being abused at home? Am I under threat right now? That's like basic, simple, you are not safe. In those situations, right, direct action to get safe is what's required, right? Get out of the dangerous situation, period. When those kind of situations happen in our life, the trauma means not the event itself so much as the symptom going on for many years of feeling like I'm in that under that threat when I'm no longer under that threat. So if I was abused or attacked at some point, later on, I still feel like I'm being attacked even when I'm not. Healing from that is to recognize on a bodily level that I'm safe from that direct threat. What that means, and then two other kinds of safety. You mentioned existential safety. So, you know, there are the big unsafeties, climate change, etc., capitalism, yada yada. We are not, none of us are safe from those things. And then there's the profound unsafety, which is that nobody is safe in any era, in any time, in any place from old age, sickness, and death. And this is the basis of the path. There's actually safety from those things is unattainable except through liberation. I'll talk later about what liberation maybe is, but there's the idea that, like, this is the whole point, is to get safe from those things. The distinction, then, is not whether I'm safe in this moment, other than that I'm safe enough from direct physical harm. The distinction is, can I perceive the safety that I'm in enough for my vigilant threat system to deactivate? And this means that I have to do a kind of skillful bracketing off of existential threat. I have to understand that I am inevitably going to grow old, if I make it that long, sick, and die. And I have to recognize that there are threats inherent to existence at the moment, like unfettered capitalism and climate change, etc., that are changeable, but only if vast numbers of people change, and more or less, they are out of my hands in a direct way. And what that means is that either I'm going to devote every waking moment to changing those conditions, and some folks are doing that, and God bless them for their well-being in taking on those challenges. All of us need to do it a little bit. But if I'm going to take any kind of break from them, like to meditate, I have to be able to bracket them off and say, although this is a threat, I am not attending to it right now. And I'm going to perceive as much safety as I can right now. And this opens an interesting possibility, which is that it's actually possible to be under significant threat and still relax, especially when we know that the threat is more or less out of our hands. So the distinction to make around safety, then, is between direct psychophysical threat that I need to be safe from, and everything else is the perception of safety. I need to perceive enough, or the perception of enough safety, for the nervous system to relax. And that's all that's needed, right? We know that we'll all die, and there's no telling when. Right? We could have an earthquake the moment after now and die. So if I focus on that, if I focus on existential threat, I won't be able to concentrate. I won't be able to enter samadhi. So I have to actually be like, have a certain sort of yep about those big threats. And be like, for now, nice room, nice people, cool, nose tip. So I have to have enough safety to be able to let go of everything else. Yeah? Yeah, thanks for asking. We'll talk more about the safety piece in the trauma conversation next month. Yeah, for sure. It's pretty much our time. Anything sort of short, anything on the tip of the nose? And then we'll say goodnight.
This may be short. You had mentioned in passing that some people argue that the deeper states of samadhi are either, you said, unnecessary or unattainable at this time.
Yes.
That piqued my interest. I was wondering if you could say more on that.
There's a school of Burmese vipassana that emphasizes continuous, non-concentrated mindfulness, and then says that the deeper states of jhana or samadhi are not necessary for liberating insight. My experience having studied in that tradition, one of those traditions, is that what they call not very concentrated is still quite concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, yeah, you're not entering jhana, but you're supposed to be continuously mindful of every single thing you do and sense and think from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep every single day without a break for months on end. So that's bloody concentrated, as far as I can tell. But what they're not doing is dropping away from sensations into absolute single-pointed renunciation of engagement with anything, jhana. And so then that's them saying those states are unnecessary. They found themselves so concentrated that they had to invent a new term that's not in the early texts called vipassana jhana, to explain the fact that they were doing something else, but it was having all the same or similar enough in interesting ways results. So that was the unnecessary camp. That's the Mahasi school, Mahasi and Upandita of Burmese Vipassana. And that's just talking about the Theravada. There's a whole other folks, like the Advaita folks and whatnot, who also think these things are unnecessary, but for different reasons. And the unattainable seems to arise every few generations. Like, the practice slips away, and then some folks are like, yeah, nobody can do this anymore. And it seems like at the beginning of the 20th century, there were very few dedicated meditators or meditation teachers anywhere in the South Asian Buddhist world. Meditators were studying and doing other things, but not really meditating. And there were revivals of meditation throughout South Asia that basically invented the practice that we're doing now. And again, they were revived partly in the context of British colonialism and an attempt to preserve the Dhamma in the face of what seemed like impending colonial apocalypse. So Burmese Vipassana was substantially reinvented. Sri Lankan Buddhism was reinvented partly by or initiated by a really cuckoo Western theosophist named Colonel Alcott, related to Louisa May of Little Women fame. These practices were reinvented. And through the 20th century, there grew lineages where people said, oh, actually, these things can be attained. when Westerners went to India and South Asia in the 60s and 70s, they mostly studied with non-jhana lineages, came back and said, and repeated the teachings they had gotten, that these deep states were not necessary. And this is partly why mindfulness was airlifted, as you said, out of the rest. It's powerful on its own. Concentration takes years and years and years of solitary retreat for most people. We don't have the time, really, people. And then as Buddhism's matured here, some practitioners, especially the ones with talent for it, found themselves wanting to go further, reading the texts and being like, yeah, that showering bliss thing, let's do that. And figured out how to do it. And so now there's a whole set of folks, both South Asian and Western, who have very fully revived these practices, and there are multiple lineages. And hella folks around now, relatively speaking, only a few, but who have actually really gone as far as one can go with these things, you know, really done the most technically rigorous traditional practice, some reinvention of it anyway, all the way. So there, it's back. And that is to say that historically we are in a generation where it's back, and it could well be that 300 years from now it disappears again. And this is I'll end with this. The Buddha says there are a few conditions that are the cause of the Dhamma or the Dharma disappearing from the world. And one of them is nobody can concentrate anymore. If nobody knows how to attain these states, the Dharma will disappear from the world. So if you find yourself good at these things, let me know. Because I think it's good that people can do them. It's good that they exist. So thanks for asking. Awesome. We'll do a little more on samadhi next week, and then we'll go into trauma for June. Thank you for your presence and your love, for your gifts of your resources in the form of money and your time, of course, donations in the basket to support an anti-capitalist offering of the teachings of the Buddha. See you Sunday if you can come, 11 o'clock in Willard Park, to a little picnic. And it's really sweet to see everyone tonight.